ethics of anyone in the country today. And I don't have the particulars. Jim just reminded me of them now. I'm sorry, I don't have the particular times. But would you check around on some of the posters? Sagoff's title is going to be, Do We Have Responsibilities to the Environment? The answer is no. That ought to be fairly provocative, and I would strongly urge you to check where those are going to be. I suspect they're in relation either to science and technology society or the biology and society program, one of those. But they would be good lectures to be aware of. Carl has his rough drafts ready to return, and he may announce that at the end of the class, too. And I also want to announce at the end of the class that I want to urge you to make more of an effort to be here on time. More and more of you have been drifting in late, but I'll say something towards the end of the class if I remember that. So Sagoff and Carolyn Merchant. Sagoff is something of a character. He is very sort of a phenomenon in a way. He's a true intellectual and can irritate the daylights out of you, but extraordinarily provocative and stimulating and insightful in terms of his thinking. And I do urge you to check those times and places. As I was working on the subject of biocentric ethics and also animal rights, I realized again that the development of culture and cultural shifts such as we are witnessing in the area of environmental awareness and environmental ethics come about in very interesting ways. I am not a biocentric in my own thinking, and yet I have to admit that the biocentrists have contributed a great deal to how we think about the environment. It seems to me that it's clear that, particularly in the Western world, we had become extraordinarily turned in on ourselves and our own interests, our own programs, and had more and more come to see nature simply as our patient, that upon which we operate, that which we control and dominate. We talked just a little bit about some of the language, for instance, that Francis Bacon used. We hound nature. We set traps for her. We pursue her. I commented on the interesting use also of the feminine and the kind of domination, exploitation theme. And even though ultimately I do not agree with where the biocentrics come out, it does seem to me that we are enormously indebted to a whole range of writers who are... I'm just curious more than anything else what that noise is. Are they working outside? Or? Oh, okay. We are enormously indebted to these writers for calling us back to some degree of sanity in our thinking about the environment. This morning I want to focus mainly on the animal welfare, animal rights issue, but at least to begin with, I wanted to make this acknowledgement. And let me indicate a little bit where I come out on the issue. It does seem to me that the biocentrics are essentially correct in this assertion, in this belief, this claim that the human being is too puny, too small, too insignificant in some ways to be the center of everything. That seems essentially right to me, and therefore either some kind of biocentrism or some kind of theocentrism seems infinitely more appropriate to me than anthropocentrism. The major problem, I'm going to suggest, with biocentrism is that it in itself does not give us any substantial clues as to how to proceed. People say we ought to live in harmony with nature, and to some extent that does give us a clue. We do have an intuitive awareness and a kind of common sense seat of the pants awareness that the way we've been doing it is pretty bad. We have been exploiting nature, destroying, living in such a way that simply is not sustainable. But on the other hand, if you try to take a biocentric position as your foundational position and say we ought to live according to nature or in harmony with nature, this, it seems to me, does not help us very much in terms of specifically how we ought to proceed, because the question that comes up immediately is what parts of nature? How do you guide your life according to nature? Because nature gives us many, many different clues. It gives us pictures of predation, of conflict, of cooperation, and so on. And the issue then still remains, how do we go about doing this? And how do human beings fit into this larger framework? If we say we want to live in a life-centered way, this still raises for us the question, which lives and how do we actually act in particular situations? And we've already touched on this a little bit in my infamous caterpillar example, the thought experiment. And we will be touching on it again this morning in looking at Peter Singer and Tom Regan and others. That is, it seems clear to me that it's not enough simply to say prefer life in a world where none of us, human or non-human, have the option of preferring all life. Human beings have, as long as we have any record, been uneasy with the fact that life lives upon life. And thus, we find in many different mythologies and stories about origins and so on, we find accounts of the long-lost golden age where we all lived in harmony with nature and did not kill, did not have to eat other animals. And we also see, even in the Western world, Judaism has various eschatological accounts, accounts of the end time where we're all living in harmony together, that is the entire animal world. So we have been uneasy, and I think understandably and rightly so, with having to live on other life, at least other animal life. But then the question still remains for us, whose life is to be preferred, and what does it really mean to live in a biocentric way? I'm going to suggest, for instance, that one of the most honest writers in this area, I think, is Paul Taylor in his Ethics of Respect for Nature, because he tells us right up front what he's doing, that he's starting with various initial assumptions, and there is something powerfully attractive about his argument that all life is of equal value. The problem, as I indicated in an earlier lecture, is simply that it becomes extremely difficult when you get to the point of implementation. And thus it's not at all surprising in his full-length book that he fudges almost all of the issues when it comes to implementation. Now this morning I want to focus more specifically on Singer and Regan, those two in particular, and raise not only some questions about their way of arguing the case, but also to alert you to the fact, which I'm sure some of you are already aware of, namely that it's not obvious that concern for animal welfare or animal rights on the level of individual animals is very helpful in terms of environmental or ecological realities, because on a larger ecological perspective, we do not think in terms of individuals, we think in terms of populations, and concern for individual animals, if it were carried out with any philosophical consistency, I think would be ecologically very problematic. I'll indicate later why I think that's the case. Let me summarize Peter Singer's position in his book, Animal Liberation. He starts with the affirmation that we consider each human being to be of the same basic worth as each other. Some would question that, but it clearly is the case that that is roughly correct in terms of where we have been over the last few centuries in the Western world. This is not something we came to all at once. You're very well aware of the fact that we only slowly began to realize the powerful inconsistencies in our thinking where people of other races or perhaps gender differences, where everyone was not seen as the same worth as every other. And then Singer also correctly, I think, says, although I'll raise some questions too about this, he says this is not based on empirical fact. Actually, I should not say correctly, because I think he has a problem here, which I will indicate. This is not based on empirical fact, but is a moral ideal. For obviously, when we look around us, people are not of equal value or worth, at least in the sense of any measurable, observable qualifications. We all the time see that some are stronger than others, some healthier than others, some are more musical than others, more intelligent than others, and so on. So empirically, it's clearly the case that in terms of many things that we value highly, people are not of equal worth. He says this is a moral ideal. He says the principle of equality among humans does not call for equal treatment. This is his third point, which obviously would not make much sense given the very different conditions and needs of different people, but it calls for equal consideration. That is, to treat people who are radically unequal, someone with severe brain damage or physically handicapped in some severe way, to treat them the same as people who did not suffer those handicaps would be to result in substantial injustice. The handicapped person could not survive at all if we push that to any extreme. So it's not that we treat one another equally, it's that we are to give each other equal consideration. Then he goes on and in developing his argument, and he says that to have interests at all, a being must be sentient, S-E-N-T-I-E-N-T, sentient, that is capable of suffering and of experiencing enjoyment. That is, Singer does not believe, for instance, that a rock or a river, water as such, or even a plant, and also some of the lower animal life forms have what we could reasonably call sentience. That is, they do not seem to be capable of suffering and experiencing enjoyment. Their neural development is not up to that level of achievement. He says, fifthly, he says, if we do not extend this principle of equality with its attendant equal consideration to animals as well as humans, we will be guilty of what he terms speciesism. Speciesism, it's a hard word to pronounce. It's sort of an awkward term in terms of how it sounds. If we do not extend this principle of equality with its attendant equal consideration to animals as well as humans, we will be guilty, says Peter Singer, of speciesism. This is because humans, there are no fundamental differences between humans and animals. Differences are all a matter of degree, not of kind. Human beings are not fundamentally different from animals. There's a kind of steady progression from the lower, simpler life forms all the way up to human beings. He says, indeed, there are many animals whose lives are clearly more valuable than those of some human beings. I've used this example before. He argues, for instance, that a healthy pig is more valuable than a brain-damaged infant. I mentioned that I'm somewhat sensitive to this comparison because of the severe brain damage that my wife has suffered through multiple sclerosis. He says, and I quote, but there will surely be some non-human incidentally, just a note that's, I think, of some worth. Whenever a writer uses the term surely or certainly or without doubt, it's my experience over the years that that's a red flag that you better watch out for, because it's almost always used when we're not so sure. It's a very, very valuable key or clue to reading critically. Usually, when we really are sure, we feel very little compulsion to use that term. And I can remember one of my doctoral advisors at Harvard made that point one time, and I've observed that over the years, and I think he was essentially correct. So watch it when either I or anyone you're reading or any speaker uses the term surely or certainly or without doubt. He says, but there will surely be some non-human animals whose lives by any standards are more valuable than the lives of some humans. Adult chimpanzees, dogs, pigs, and members of many other species far surpass the brain-damaged infant in their ability to relate to others, act independently, be self-aware, and any other capacity that could reasonably, the emphasis is mine, be said to give value to life. Just another aside, a book I'm working on now, I'm focusing particularly on how we use the term reasonably. That's another term that I think we want to be very, very careful about, because it's often used in what I would call a semantically imperialistic manner or a metaphysically imperialistic manner. It's used to exclude those often who do not think like we do. But when someone says, my philosophy or my position is based on reason and yours is based on either emotions or feelings or faith or dogma, hold on to your wallet. Something often a little bit fishy is going on at that point, because it seems to me clearly the case that all human reasoning starts with certain initial assumptions and commitments, and it will then be judged reasonable or unreasonable in terms of what it does with those. But to simply brush aside other ways of thinking as unreasonable, we need to be careful. I want to come back to that right towards the end. Now, I want to offer some comments on Singer, but first let me summarize Tom Regan's position, perhaps the other best-known figure in the case of animal welfare, animal rights. Singer is writing as a utilitarian. Tom Regan is writing as a deontologist, someone who starts with a kind of rights framework. Summarize their position is not quite the appropriate term. I'm picking out a few key aspects that I think will be helpful in interpreting their importance for environmentalism. Regan argues that as individual human beings, we each possess what he calls inherent value. We each possess inherent value. And he says, and I quote, to ensure that we do not pave the way for such injustices as slavery or sexual discrimination, we must believe that all who have inherent value have it equally, regardless of their sex, race, religion, birthplace, and so on. Regan calls this position the rights view. He says in the third place that attempts to limit the scope of the rights view to humans only can be shown to be rationally defective. If you think that only human beings have rights, you are rationally defective, a fairly strong term, particularly in academic circles. He proceeds and comments that animals too have inherent value. Indeed, inherent value, says Tom Regan, equal to that of humans. This is from his book, The Case for Animal Rights. He also has a number of key articles. Actually, this particular quote is from his essay, Animal Rights and Human Obligations. He says, some there are, and I'm quoting him here, who resist the idea that animals have inherent value. Only humans have such value, they profess. How might this narrow view be defended? Shall we say that only humans have the requisite intelligence or autonomy or reason? But there are many, many humans who fail to meet these standards and yet are reasonably viewed as having value above and beyond their usefulness to others. Shall we claim that only humans belong to the right species, the species Homo sapiens, but this is blatant speciesism? Well, he continues, perhaps some will say that animals have some inherent value, only less than we have. Once again, however, attempts to defend this view can be shown to lack rational justification. What could be the basis of our having more inherent value than animals? Now, Regan goes on to say, we are each of us what he calls the experiencing subject of a life, the experiencing subject of a life, a conscious creature having an individual welfare that has importance to us, whatever our usefulness to others. We are self-conscious. We are aware of our living. We're aware of things that hurt us and things that make us happy. He says animals have a right to be treated with respect that is equal to that of humans, for they too are experiencing subjects of a life. Now, Paul Taylor, I will just, as I've commented, I won't look at his thinking in any detail, is even more radical than Singer and Regan, because he wants to extend this equality to plants as well as to animals. Now, what do we make of this in terms of the kinds of considerations that have been raised in the course so far? How do we evaluate the work of Singer and Regan? I think, again, first of all, we are enormously indebted to these writers. Whatever one thinks of the particular conclusions or even the particular way of arguing the case, we are indebted to them. And I should point out right away, for instance, that Regan and Singer, for instance, differ substantially in their argumentation. Their arguments are not compatible with each other. Basically, if you look at Singer's position very carefully, as a utilitarian, what he's really saying is that none of us has any value. All that is valuable is happiness and good feelings and pleasure, and all that is evil is suffering and pain. This is a critique, of course, which is relevant to all utilitarian thinking, that none of you has any value in absolute terms. All that has value is what you are experiencing. Regan, for instance, finds that aspect of Singer's thinking very, very troubling. So the two writers do not agree with each other, even though each of them sees his position as rationally compelling. But before offering this kind of critique, let me again affirm that they have awakened us in a very important way. It's my conviction, for instance, that the part of Singer's book, Animal Liberation, that has really had the most impact is not his philosophical argumentation, but those couple hundred pages where he details the awful conditions in factory farming and in various experiments in laboratories with animals and so on. I find that it's almost impossible to read those pages without being deeply moved and without sensing at some very fundamental level that something's wrong, and indeed seriously wrong, even if we can justify the use of animals in cancer research or AIDS research or something of this sort, the kinds of frivolous ways we've used them for developing 1,000 different varieties of cosmetics and so on seems to me questionable, seriously questionable. And even though it places his descriptions of veal factory farming and even the way we raise chickens are subject to some criticism in talking with people who know these areas better than I do, they believe that he distorts and exaggerates at some point. Nonetheless, I think he has awakened our consciousness to this terrible, manipulative, exploitative, indifferent way that we have treated fellow living creatures who suffer great pain, and we have simply not taken this very seriously. And I want to emphasize this because when I offer a criticism of their thinking, it is a criticism within the context of substantial appreciation. Now, Singer starts with the principle of equality among humans, but he never discusses where this belief or moral ideal comes from. And it's not a universal belief, and it's not even a universal belief in our own cultural background. It seems much more obvious as we look around us that we're not of equal value. It's very hard to believe in one sense that someone who has no arms or legs or only half a brain is of equal value to an Olympic athlete or Albert Einstein or whatever. Where did this belief come from that we are of equal value? Singer quite overlooks the fact that at least in the Western world, and actually one would largely have to confine oneself to the Western world because that's where this belief has been most prominent. In Hinduism, for instance, it's very obviously the case that people are not of equal value in the sense that the untouchable and the Brahman have very, very different roles and value. But in the Western world, this belief in the equal value of all human beings is historically very closely related to the concept of the Imago Dei, the image of God. Why are we of equal value in spite of the fact that every one of us looks so different and has such different capabilities? Answer, because each one of us has been created in God's image. And this fact that we are bearers of the Imago Dei, of the image of God, gives us equal value totally apart from whatever the particularities of our historical situation are. Now, Singer, interestingly, wants to keep the ideal but reject its historical basis, that is, the concept of the image of God. I find that interesting. I don't object to his wanting to keep the ideal. I think it's a fine ideal. It's a correct ideal. But one needs to realize that it functions for him simply as an assumption. And what I find even more interesting is that he accepts the ideal of creation in the image of God, but utterly rejects views about the human-animal relationship that are based in a religious understanding of the world. He rejects these views and considers them fundamentally irrational. For instance, in Animal Liberation, in footnote 14 on page 270, it's interesting that it's relegated only to a footnote. He says, and I quote, "I am putting aside here religious views, for example, the doctrine that all and only human beings have immortal souls or are made in the image of God. Historically, these have been very important and no doubt are partly responsible for the idea that human life has a special sanctity." I think that's mistaken. They're largely responsible in the Western world. "Logically, however, these religious views are unsatisfactory since they do not offer a reasoned explanation of why it should be that all humans and no non-humans have immortal souls. This belief, too, therefore, comes under suspicion as a form of speciesism. In any case, defenders of the sanctity of life view are generally reluctant to base their position on purely religious doctrines, since these doctrines are no longer as widely accepted as they once were." Now, I find that an incredible explanation. It's and I want to focus on it a little bit because it so very nicely captures the bias and bigotry of the modern academic world towards religion and religious ideas. I had an interesting experience on Saturday. I gave a paper at a conference here at Cornell on religion and cultural dynamics, and I focused on the bias against religious ethics in the broader area of environmental ethics, that particularly in our tax-supported institutions, we will have secular philosophers doing environmental ethics, but we do not typically hire Jews or Muslims or Christians or others to actually work on environmental ethics from the standpoint of their particular worldview and their beliefs. After I finished the 20-minute summary of the paper, I had handed out a full written copy of it. There were 10 minutes left for questions, and one person got up and said this was just a fantastically interesting talk, and it was almost embarrassing what he said. Another person got up, another professor, and said, "Well, I'm very puzzled by this talk because you know, you really shouldn't be doing this at Cornell. If people want to talk about God and religious ethics, they have churches and seminaries. Why are you doing this in public, so to speak?" And then a third professor got up and said, "This is the most irritating talk. You've made me more upset than anything I've heard in 20 years. And without thinking, I said, "Praise the Lord, that's wonderful," which really irritated him. Then he really was mad. And I found these responses just incredible, because basically what they were saying, and this is so very, very common, is that we now as a society, in our universities and so on, will tolerate Jews, Christians, Muslims, as long as they sit in the back of the bus, as long as they sort of keep quiet and don't really think they have anything important to say. We'll tolerate them doing descriptive work in the university. That is, let's have some anthropologists and historians discussing what these peculiar people do, you know, how they think and what their practices are. But to think that they might have the right to actually wrestle with environmental problems and so on the basis of their particular beliefs is somewhere between embarrassing and obscene. This passage from Singer very nicely unpacks, I think, this bias. That is, he says, These views have been important historically, but he says logically these religious views are unsatisfactory since they do not offer a reasoned explanation of why it should be that all humans and no non-humans have immortal souls. That's just silly. First of all, it's silly because theologians and theological ethicists do give apologies or defenses or explanations of why they believe what they do. But it's silly in another sense that Singer himself does not give any reasoned explanation of his basic assumptions. He does not tell us why we ought to believe that all human beings are equal. He simply says this is a moral ideal. Fine. But that does not mean that it's a moral ideal which everyone has to accept. He says logically they're unsatisfactory because they're not based on reason. But again, what does this phrase based on reason really mean? My sense is that there is a kind of fundamental slipperiness in much philosophical ethics because people want to give the impression that these views are based on reason, but religious people do it by faith. And I simply think that's it's really a rather silly way of looking at it, because it overlooks the fact that all of us must start with certain initial assumptions, and reason functions in terms of what we do with them and how we proceed. His last comment that these doctrines, maybe we shouldn't pay so much attention to them since these doctrines are no longer as widely accepted as they once were, is also silly. It's silly because these views are very, very much more widely accepted than his own views or the assumptions of most secular philosophers. My critique of Regan would be very similar to my critique of Singer. Like Singer, Regan simply assumes that there are no qualitative differences between animals and humans. That also is a very, very big assumption, and I don't think the empirical data ultimately resolves that for us. One can be aware of the fact that human beings share something over 99% of their genetic makeup with orangutans or mountain gorillas. I don't think that in itself resolves the issue because we don't know what that other 1% involves, or we don't know if it's even significant because most traditional Christians, for instance, have believed that the immortal soul or the spirit is not an empirical reality in any case. Regan, too, rejects the idea of an immortal soul or some other distinctive quality possessed by humans and not by animals. He writes, "Will it be said then that all and only humans have immortal souls? Then our opponents have their work cut out for them. I am not myself ill-disposed to the proposition that there are immortal souls. Personally, I profoundly hope I have one." I don't know if he's really being truthful there or not. I'm a little suspicious in terms of his other writing. "But I would not want to rest my position on a controversial ethical issue on the even more controversial question about who or what has an immortal soul. That is to dig one's hole deeper and not to climb out. Rationally," notice again, like the term surely, certainly, without doubt, rationally, pay attention to that term when you see it, "it is better to resolve moral issues without making more controversial assumptions than are needed." Now, again, notice, for very many people, it does not seem more controversial to believe that human beings were created in the image of God or have an immortal soul or something of the sort than to believe that we are of equal worth with a pig or a dog or a mouse, as Regan believes. I think most people would find that much more difficult to believe than much more controversial than the belief in something like an immortal soul. He says, rationally, it is better to resolve moral issues without making more controversial assumptions than are needed. The question of who has inherent value is such a question, one that is resolved more rationally without the introduction of the idea of immortal souls than by its use. If I had time, I would make some similar comments on Taylor. I find Taylor refreshing in the sense that I think he's very much more upfront with what he's doing. He tells us right out straight that this is a belief system, that it's based on assumptions that he makes, and he's not trying to persuade us somehow that to believe differently than he does is to be rationally defective. That's a rather strong term, as I've indicated. The main problem I have with Taylor's thinking is I don't know what to do with it in terms of implementation. And thus, it does not seem surprising to me that the whole last third of his book, I think, is philosophically incoherent. Because if you really believe that a dandelion or a mosquito or a blade of grass is as valuable as a human being, then it seems to me all kinds of human activities would have to be proscribed because of the mass slaughter and destruction of other creatures. I think that the book is utterly incoherent in the end. Now, what do I make of all of this? I think the significance for environmental ethics and for environmental policy is that we have to stop playing games with each other in the way many secular philosophers are doing. I think the claim that Regan and Singer and to some extent Callicott and other secular philosophers are making, that theirs is the rationally compelling way of seeing these issues, and that if you don't agree with them, you're somehow rationally defective. I think this is a preposterous claim in today's world. It's humorous in the sense that they don't seem to sense the humor that they disagree with each other on many of these issues. But I think it's destructive in the sense that where they do agree with each other is in a kind of wholesale marginalization and disenfranchisement of people who approach these issues from an essentially religious background. And it's my sense that this kind of bigotry utterly pervades the modern academic world, and that it is a bigotry that we have to begin to name. And we have to begin to ask, what would it take in our universities and our public institutions to have a higher degree of fairness and open-mindedness and justice in terms of how we deal with ideas? My conviction is that these issues of who we are as human beings in relation to animals and nature are anything but obviously resolved, either by Christian or Jewish or by secular, utilitarian, or deontological frameworks. Even though I, as a Christian, believe that the Christian view on these things is a true view, I am aware of the fact that it is obviously not true in such a way that every person immediately says, Yavol, I see what you're talking about, that's correct. That the reality is that we live in a world where we either are going to start to listen to each other and try to understand what each other is saying and have a certain respect for each other, or we will, as I've indicated in earlier lectures, be moving closer and closer to culture wars. Because it seems to me what we have today is very close to the polar opposite of the attitude of the Catholic medieval church that error has no rights. And my perception is that in many aspects, the modern secular university basically says, if you're thinking about environmental issues and about the world in which we live is religiously grounded, you have no rights in the university. We will allow you to do descriptive work, but don't think that you have any right as a part of the university to do normative work, that is actually to wrestle with current moral issues vis-a-vis the environment and propose solutions. That ought to be done in private, not in the public sphere of the university. And it's my conviction that we face an issue here that is very similar to what the ecofeminists are wrestling with. That the traditionally male-dominated ways of thinking basically said that if you give any particular place to care and concern and love and feelings of responsibility, that will simply cloud your thinking. Taylor says this very clearly, that if your thinking is not totally impartial and dispassionate and disinterested, it probably will not be rational. Now, to me, that's an utterly bizarre assumption that has had very deleterious effects on the modern Western world and, in particular, on how we deal with the environment. Because I think it is precisely what we need today is some of the kinds of things that these ecofeminist writers are presenting that have to do with care and relationship and holistic, nurturing thinking that I think is most likely to change the way we live and actually treat the environment. And if we proceed with this kind of bias, this disenfranchising of what Plumwood and Gilligan and others think of as more feminine ways of thinking about nature and environment, I think we impoverish ourselves. And it's my considered judgment also that that's exactly what has happened in terms of religiously grounded thinking about the environment. It can be done descriptively, but not normatively. It's like saying to a physicist or a chemist, we will allow you to be at the university and write learned papers about what chemists and physicists have done in past centuries, but we will never allow you to enter a laboratory because you're not supposed to do physics and chemistry at this university. You're just supposed to discuss what other people have done. And that's exactly the way most large secular universities have treated religious ethics, including ethics about the environment. So I think that what we have here in Singer and Regan is a very interesting example of this kind of bigotry. And it's my hope that we can move towards educational structures in our society where we truly will have respect for one another, where we will not insist that someone, Michal, like yourself, who is trying to approach environmental ethics as a believing Jew, that you sort of just do this in private, or that we will just tolerate you as a kind of curiosity, but nothing more. It seems to me there's something essentially wrong with that kind of attitude which is so predominant in the modern university. I don't know all of the details of how we begin to move in that direction, but I am confident that somehow that kind of change will begin to happen. And as I have indicated, I fear that if it does not happen, we are going to be moving towards a period of culture wars where the fabric of our society is increasingly going to disintegrate. I think that there was a long period when Christians took a similar attitude towards humanists, atheists, Jews, and others. Now we flip-flopped in the other direction, and what I'm calling for is a kind of synthesis where we believe that none of us has any absolutely clear hold on truth, even though each of us may believe that her own position is true. We have to find new ways in our educational structures of showing respect to one another. Okay, you've heard me say these things before, but I thought this was an especially interesting example of how this works itself out in practice. Thank you. Yes, Carl. Yes, yes.